How you doing out there, ladies and gentlemen? This is Tim Benal with BenalofAmerica.com. Welcome to yet another edition of Benal of America Audio Season 1. I want to thank everybody who checked out the Jim Mars season premiere over the last couple weeks. I'm just totally amazed at the downloads and feedback we got on this. And I hope you stick around and enjoy the rest of Benal of America Audio Season 1. Tonight, we feature Marshall Klarfeld, author of Atom, The Missing Link. I lay out Marshall's bio in the interview, so we'll skip right ahead to the actual interview this week. This interview was conducted on August 5th, 2005, with Marshall Klarfeld, author of Atom, The Missing Link.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest this week is Marshall Klarfeld. He's the author of Atom, The Missing Link. Here's a little bit about him from his website. I'm sure he's going to give us some more background anyway when we talk. As an undergraduate student at Caltech in the late 1940s, Marshall was fascinated by the advanced scientific knowledge found in the Bible's story of creation. Genesis describes the creation of our solar system as occurring in a six-day time frame. His question was, how did this 5,000-year-old Bible description of the birth of our solar system disclose the advanced scientific information? The ignition of our sun occurs at the fourth day in a six-day creation process, thousands of years before we discovered it. Uncertain how to unravel this puzzle, he questioned his Nobel laureate professors, Linus Pauling and Richard Feynman. Their powerful answers stayed with him for decades and inspired him to pursue the knowledge that he is now able to share with the readers of Atom, The Missing Link. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Marshall Klarfeld to Benal of America Audio.
Thank you, Tim. That was very precise.
Well, why don't you give me a little bit of your background before you got into this area of research?
Okay, as I said, I entered Caltech in 1947, which was kind of an auspicious year because Roswell occurred just across the state lines, and the words UFO came into our language at that time. I spent 4 years, graduated in 1951, went on to the 30-year career in industry, working for Wallace Johnson up in Berkeley with a company called Upright, and then retired. Found out that I wasn't the retiring type, so I, after traveling extensively in the Pacific Rim, got into real estate. Then I decided that my real passion in life, Tim, was to find answers to these questions that have been haunting me ever since my formative years in college at Caltech. And there were all kinds of questions that I didn't know the answers to. And as I researched, I found the Internet was a wonderful instrument. It just really was able to produce answers to things that before then I was, you know, I could spend hours in a library, but on the Internet you can find things pretty quickly. Ran into the works of Zechariah Sitchin. And Zechariah Sitchin, I read all 9 of his books after I discovered him and most of his articles, gave enough information that the pieces started to fit together. And once I saw the mosaic forming up and kind of making sense to me, I said, well, now how do I prove this? Here's a guy who's got a theory and it seems like it works. We were genetically engineered, basically, is what his theory says. So I proceeded to try to find the physical facts that would verify the theory. And they're right here on planet Earth. I went around, as I say, doing my investigative research and put together a series of artifacts, texts, and really what I'd call a way to handle the information. I created what, to me, I don't know if it's ever been done before, was a theory of information transfer. And what I mean by that, Tim, is that all the things that I was encountering had information stored in them, but they need to be put into categories. So I started with the first one, which I called SIT, Stored Information Text. I called that the information coming out of the cuneiform tablets.
Okay.
This was information that was being stored in text form. The second item was the cylinder seals. They fascinated me. These little stone engraved devices which you could pat out on wet clay and roll the cylinder across the wet clay, and you get a positive kind of picture story. And that's a device, a stored information device. So I call that the SID, stored information device. And then I went on to the pyramids, and I call those stored information structures, SIFC. And then stored information sculptures. In those four categories, I was able to take and look at all the information that I was gathering, and then I decided to write a book.
You used the Sitchin work for your research. What other sources did you find that you were looking into? Some of the von Daniken stuff. I don't know.
I read von Daniken, but besides. I tried to verify the translations of Sitchin. In other words, I was skeptical of what one man was saying the thing said, and then I did some research on the Sumerian language, which is what the original tablets were written in, and I found out, Tim, that it's a peculiar language. Sumerian is unlike any other language that exists on our planet. It's the first written language, and it is subject to, you know, a variety of translations. So I investigated four or five other people who had translated, like, the Epic of Gilgamesh. I used that as my kind of yardstick.
Okay, yeah.
And I found out that they pretty much said the same thing. Now, Sitchin claims that he had translated over 2,000 tablets that dealt with the early formation of our solar system and the creation of mankind. These were texts that he's published in various books, and I found them to be very fascinating. In fact, I quote him quite often in my book, if you've read it.
I've taken a look at it.
Yeah, you'll notice that when I see an artifact that matches up with a tablet translation, I put them together in the book. Now, the book is not like most complex scientific journals that tell the story. I've reduced it into kind of an 8.5 by 11, like Life magazine format. So it comes out and has a bunch of pictures, like probably 145 pictures with a little bit of text explaining what the pictures mean.
Yeah, I took a look at the book, and I was actually really impressed by that because what I was thinking, I saw one of the pictures had the, I'm not sure what exactly it was. It was stone, but it looked like a helicopter on it.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, that's on the Egyptian temple at below Cairo. It's kind of an interesting artifact because it shows not only the device that looks like a helicopter, it also shows what was the Ark, which is kind of like a submarine.
Yep.
And then it shows a glider, which could be a space shuttle. And all of these images, which are over 3,000 years old and, found on this ceiling of this temple in Egypt, seem to me to say, well, what were they looking at? The folks that were sculpting this thing, Tim, had to see something that looked like that. And I'm not sure those are exactly what they were, but I was fascinated by the submarine with the snorkel stem on it.
Yeah.
Because Sitchin's theory is that the flood was a tsunami, that it came from the South Atlantic when the ice shelf got sent in there by the passage of Nibiru that came through one time and shoved this huge amount of ice into the ocean, causing this huge tsunami. And an ark wouldn't survive floating on top of the water. It would have to be kind of a submersible design to actually survive that kind of a event.
And the people who are listening right now, actually, they can see the picture we're talking about. It's on the preview. You can preview the book at adamthemissinglink.com. So
yes.
If they're wondering what we're talking about, they can actually see the picture. So that might be helpful.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that because I did make available about 5 or 6 pages that they can click. There's a little button on the bottom of the picture of the book, Adam the Missing Link, And when you hit that, you get inside the book and see 3 or 4 or 5 pages.
Yeah, so people who are like, what are they talking about? They can go and check it out now while they're listening to the audio, which is always nice. And what I liked about that part of the book, and I'm sure the rest of the book too, is that with a lot of these textbooks, you can't, you know, you hand someone a book, you don't know if they're going to read it or not. You know, they might skim it. Well, this book, with all the pictures, you can actually show someone and say, look at this, you know. Look at here, how you explain this, how you explain that, instead of expecting them to read. People are lazy. They're not going to read nowadays.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And thank you for mentioning that, Tim, because that's part of my design. My design of getting this information out, which is, you know, some of it is a repetition of what Sitchin has said. Some of it's new that I've discovered. But the whole idea is to keep the dialogue going. This is a story that needs to get worldwide attention. It just is crying to be learned and taught in schools. Now, this big debate going on in the cover of Time magazine this week that's going on in our schools is, what do we teach our children? You know, and most of the argument that's going on is between evolution and ID, which is called intelligent design. And that's kind of another way of saying creationism, what the Bible says. So we got the story of the Bible, and we got the story of what Darwin wrote in his book. And the science folks in the schools say, you know, they only want to teach proven scientific things, and you can't prove religion. That's the Bible part of it. Well, I'm saying that this story of Adam the Missing Link, the story of genetic engineering as it unfolds in my book, is really what should be taught, because it shows that each side on that argument is half right. You know, the evolutionists are half right and the creationists are half right. But the true facts, and when I ask some of these science teachers who are in the Kansas area, the debate is really hot in Kansas.
Yeah.
I said, well, how do you tell your kids who built the pyramids? I mean, you know, there's a scientific creation. It's one of the most magnificent structures on the planet, and we don't know how to explain who built it. Well, if you take the story of genetic engineering and the facts that I show in my book, Adam the Missing Link, you'll get a possible answer. I'm not saying, you know, exactly that's the way it happened, but it's the closest thing, Tim, that I could find.
Exactly. Yeah. Now you say you present some of the Sitchin stuff and some new stuff. So why don't you let me know a little bit about what this new stuff is?
Okay.
You know, you don't have to give away the whole farm here, but give, you know, let us
well,
know.
Well, no, that's all right.
You know, you know what I mean?
I know. One of the things that fascinated me was, why were the pyramids built? Well, in the text they said they needed a beacon for navigational purposes. When they were orbiting the Earth and coming in, they had the twin 12,000, 17,000 foot Mount Ararat peaks that were snow covered all year round. But they needed an anchor for that in Egypt, Cairo area. There wasn't anything, so they decided to build these two huge mountains. Actually, they were twin mountains, which would replicate the twin mountains at Mount Ararat. And if they covered them with the highly polished stones that glistened in the sun, they could line up the line between the two pyramids and the mountains of Turkey. Okay, so taking that as a base, I said, okay, they must have had some other problems. Now, if you go to page 36 in the book, you'll see how I got into this. It's the Easter Island story. And there's a little picture there on page 36 that shows the Earth with its dark side and its light side. And if you're orbiting around the equator in your ship, you go from the light side of the Earth to the dark side of the Earth. And then if you look at the map of the Earth laid out just below that, and you've seen this at NASA's Houston Space Center, they have these lines that go up and go down. It's kind of a sinusoidal curve.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what you see, because the Earth tilted on its axis, and as it spins under you and you're going around it, your path of sight follows this sinusoidal curve.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, when the pyramids go dark, what's the light that they've got? And I looked at the Easter Island statues, and they all face east. And they're all kind of replications of the, what the Anunnaki look like, according to cylinder seals. And their heads are tipped up, and they have polished coral eyes.
Ah.
And these 900 pairs of eyes looking up in the east will reflect the sun. And believe it or not, Easter Island is 12 hours from Cairo, where the pyramids are. So that they would be in the daylight when Cairo's in the dark.
Yeah.
And it made sense to me. I said, you know, why were these statues put on an island in the middle of nowhere? I mean, that island is 2,000 miles from anything. Absolutely. But it works as a beacon. So then I started thinking about beacons. And I said, there's got to be some other beacons that will give them direction as they're coming in. Because, you know, unlike it is today, they didn't have the ability of a infrastructure full of telescopes and radio signals that they could use. The Earth had nothing on it at the time they were using it. So I found a place called Newgrange, which is in Ireland. Well, first I had Stonehenge. Stonehenge is on page 21, and Newgrange is on page 38. Now, Newgrange, the Anunnaki, by the way, the Anunnaki is what the Sumerians called these folks, and I guess they called that themselves too. So in the Bible, there's a reference to a group called the Nephilim. And the Nephilim were described in the Bible as those who came from heaven to earth. And the Sumerians, who were the first recorded civilization on our planet, called them the Anunnaki. So if we use that word, your audience will understand what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
These are the extraterrestrials who came to this planet 450,000 years ago and started doing their thing. Well, when they built Stonehenge, Tim,
yep.
On page 21, you'll see the original, there weren't any stones. All it was a big circle, a trench really, with 56 3-foot diameter chalk holes. They eventually became the Aubrey holes, because this guy, John Aubrey, discovered them. But they reflect. In other words, if you had a circle of 56 stones, and by the way, if you filled the trench with water, and you look at it from the sky, it's black. Water reflects is black from up above. So you get a black circle with 56 white dots reflecting upward. And similar at the same time was Newgrange. Newgrange was an astronomical device which also had a highly reflective surface. That's on page 38. And if you draw a line between Newgrange and Stonehenge, guess what? It intersects the line from the pyramids to Mount Ararat at Baalbek, which is where the landing platform was.
Very interesting.
As I'm an engineer, you know, that's what I studied and graduated as, and I look at things perhaps a little bit, I'm a tire kicker.
Yeah.
And I want to get a hold of something. I want to see what it's made of. I want to see how it works. And everything I've looked at in my research on this entire project has been approached in that fashion. Why was this done? How does it work?
Yeah.
And what I just described to you was a little bit of extra information that came up. Now, by the way, there's another piece of it.
Okay.
In France, at a place called Carnac, which is on the coast of France.
Mm-hmm.
There are over 3,000 stones in a line, or in several lines. And if you look down at it from above, the position of Stonehenge and Newgrange connected with, I mean, the line between them is what gets you to the Baalbek. But offset is the same offset as the Orion Belt configuration. Now, the pyramids at Giza have that same configuration as two big ones and one little one.
Yeah.
And it's carved at an angle between the two that are in line. And I'm guesstimating that maybe they did that for that reason, to try to fulfill every place else they did it. In the Mesoamerica, when they built the pyramids there, they did the same thing. two big ones and then a little one off at an angle, which was the configuration of the Orion Belt. Now, the other thing that you ask is, you know, what else did I discover? If you remember the page that showed the Pioneer plaque?
I've seen the Pioneer plaque, so I haven't seen the page
yet. Okay, well, it's on page 9 in my book. There's a depiction of what we look like and the number of planets that we are and where this spaceship came from. But off on the left, Tim, there's a starburst design. It's actually a three-dimensional map of our solar system. Not just our solar system, but the galaxy that we're in, which is the Milky Way. And it's pointed on the 14 pulsars. If you took the 14 pulsars and intersected them, that would show where our little sun and its nine planets at that time were. So I said, why did Carl Sagan and his guys do that? They also did it on the Voyager 1 and 2 records, the gold records. They put that same starburst map. And I said, well, I guess they wanted to speak in a language that somebody who would look at it could understand, okay?
Yeah.
All right. We go to the Nazca plane where the lines, everybody's, including von Daniken, remark about. And on page 49 in my book, I discovered and reproduced the starburst configuration exactly like the one that we sent out into space. And I said, well, now, here is a map, a three-dimensional star map, perhaps showing where they came from. And I show that at the bottom of page 49. And I don't think anybody's hooked that up ever before.
Now, I remember you saying Carl Sagan, the first, was he the one that designed the plaque, right?
He and his group, yeah.
Yeah, and you said the first language they used was Sumerian?
Yes, that was on the records, on the gold records on Voyager.
Yeah.
And they had 55 languages saying hello, you know, so
yeah.
That they could. And the first language they used was Sumerian, which is a 6,000-year-old language that's not spoken anymore. And I said, yeah, I wonder why they used that language.
Exactly, that's what I was just about to ask you. Why do you think that was, why do you think they did it?
Okay. There's a problem we have with our scientific community, Tim. You've probably run into this before. They're kind of in a closet.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to come out. You know, they're afraid that what their peers will think of them if they say something or do something that recognizes that this is perhaps a story that they should be researching and talking about, but they haven't. And I think Carl Sagan maybe knew that, and because of his popularity, said, well, we're going to do this. And they did it, and nobody thought about it, but he was saying he knew. It was a way of him saying he knew.
Yeah.
But he wasn't coming out of the closet. And also, by the way, in one of his stories, I think it was one of the books he wrote, Contact?
Yeah.
His spaceship is called Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting to speculate on these things, Tim, but
he may have been tipping his hand a little bit.
A little bit. And then there's a picture of him that I reproduced in the book standing against the building, and over his left shoulder is the depiction of the 10th planet. It's the winged globe.
Ha, really?
Yeah, that's on the back of Contact. So, you know, he pictured the author on the back of the book, and there he is with over his left shoulder is the 10th planet.
Ha.
So, I don't know. This speculation on my part, I can't prove it. But I'm really on a kind of a mission, you might say, to get the scientific community to come out and start talking. Now, I just saw a movie. It's by a guy named Timothy Ferris, and I'm going to contact him. He's a physics professor up at the University of California, Berkeley.
Yeah.
And it's a PBS home video. It's called Life Beyond Earth. I'd recommend renting it and looking at it, because in it he has some beautiful pictures of how the universe works. But more important, he has 7, 8, 9 top scientists talking about, yes, there is life out in the universe. All we have to do is make contact with it. In other words, they're all talking about this, in fact, the one gal that's in there is Frances Cordova. She's the chief scientist with NASA.
Oh, really?
And she's about 40 years old, and she's just charming, and, you know, along with these other heavy-hitting scientific people, every one of them, Tim, says, yes, there is life out there. The law of probability says there is. And that's, of course, what Feynman told me when I asked him that way back. Now, my question to them is, what makes you think they haven't already been here?
Exactly.
It's only 450,000 years ago. That's nothing. All of these other systems that this life exists on are millions, billions of years older than we are. And their technology's got to be, you know, gazoos beyond us. So what's so impossible to imagine that if you have the proof here and you see all these things that you can't explain, that they've been here, that this story is true, that we were genetically engineered. I mean, after all, we're going to do it ourselves.
Exactly.
We're very close to doing it right now.
Why don't you, for the people that are just completely clueless to the whole ET progenitor concept, why don't you give a thumbnail sketch of what exactly that is? I'm sure there's people listening who are sort of trying to wrap their head around this that haven't actually had it spelled out for them.
Okay. Here's the way it goes. Just as concise as I can put it. this is according to the story that they wrote. This is there. 450,000 years ago, space travelers from a planet that already exists in our solar system called Nibiru, that's the name of their home planet, was captured billions of years ago. It was floating free in space, and Neptune's gravity caught it and brought it in, and it became part of our home system of planets. They had a problem. Since they have an atmosphere and they had their own generation of heat from their internal system on the planet, they had a hole in their atmosphere, Tim, and the hole was leaking everything out. And they tried everything to close it up, and they couldn't close it up, and they finally decided that the one thing that would close it up are flakes of gold. And didn't have any gold on their planet, so they took a survey of the solar system that they were in, found Earth as the gold, came to Earth 450,000 years ago, started mining the gold, and sending it back to their home planet to close the hole. Now, my nearest thing to that is that all of our astronauts have visors, and on the visors they have gold. It's a gold coating, and you flip the visor down and totally keeps the sun, reflects the sun out. So if you put flakes of gold in the hole in your atmosphere, enough of it, you could reflect the sun out and close the hole. Anyway, that's the story. And about 200,000 years ago, there was a mutiny amongst their workers who were digging in these African mines, which are 2 miles deep, and we're still digging in those mines today, 2 miles deep, and it's not easy to do. It's hard work, it's hot, and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
They said, not digging anymore. And so the solution was either to abandon the project and, you know, lose their home planet and come here and live, or one of the leaders said, we could make a worker here. Now, there are all these hairy creatures that are around us. There's the Homo erectus that was existing on Earth at that time. We put our mark on it. We can make a primitive worker. So they did. They described the experiments that they went through, genetically engineering the eggs of the Homo erectus female. And, you know, I can go into great detail on it, but I won't. They finally achieved their first successful genetic engineered new species. Now, this was against the prime directive. They knew that they shouldn't be met, but it was a matter of survival for them. If they did not do this, they couldn't survive on their home planet. So they created us. They created humanity by jump-starting Homo erectus, putting some of their DNA into the eggs of a female Homo erectus and producing what they called Adamu. The first successful human was Adamu. And the story went on that, you know, they created lots of them, and then they solved their problem.
And now, did they leave? Did they leave Earth after?
You
know, what happened?
Fast forward.
All right. I didn't know if you were.
No. Actually, the humans produced themselves. They were able to genetically engineer, because clones cannot reproduce themselves. They're sterile. So that they had to tinker with the anatomy again to make humans able to produce themselves, because they were being produced by the Anunnaki females. They were birth mothers. And the language that the birth mothers were talking to these babies that they were producing was Sumerian. So I think that the Sumerian language is the Anunnaki's language. That's the way I figured that out. But anyway, we became very populous. We thrived, and there was a flood. The whole flood story, by the way, is told in my book by the first printed story that ever appears on our planet is the Epic of Gilgamesh, and the 11th tablet of that 12th tablet story is the story of the flood. And I use that because I think it's an excellent insight into how they transferred information to us. But once they got to the point where they had gotten enough gold and they had, saved their planet, we had advanced to a certain point where they were helping us. They had technology transfers. An example of that, Tim, is the Sumerian civilization 9,000 years ago appears with all these firsts. And the anthropologists are not able to explain to anybody how all that happened. Well, if you just understand that there was a more advanced civilization parallel to ours that gave them all this information and materials, it makes sense. So I think what happened maybe 2000, maybe 1200 BC, they felt that we were successfully started because they had been told that their destiny was to come to this planet to create us, and it was our destiny, mankind's destiny, to inherit this planet. In order to inherit the planet and handle it, they had to have given us certain informations, which they did. So my guess is that they phased off the planet because they didn't need the gold anymore, and they didn't need to be interrelated with us. Now, there was a problem, Tim, huge problem. They'd been here for so long that there was some of them on the mother planet, Nibiru, saying that you can't come back. If you come back, you're going to die because you've adjusted to a different habitat.
Yeah.
And, there's many more facts to that story, which I put into the book so that people can understand the whole concept of how we were created, why we were created, and what they did while they were here. And I tell you, this is kind of another thing, Tim, that maybe you've caught on to, too, is that if we have their genes, and if we are kind of like them, and in effect, they're our ancestors, we act very much like they did.
Yeah.
If you read some of their exploits, they were warlike people. They fought in clans, and they had this incredible sexual appetite.
That sounds like the human race for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you said that they were told that it was their destiny to come here and to make the human race.
Yes.
Where did they get that message from?
Okay, thank you for asking that question, because it's an important part of my story. Their deity was called the Creator of All. He's the one that created the universe, or it created the universe, and they paid attention to what messages. They got dream messages from the Creator of All. And during the flood situation, when Enlil, who was the leader, said, we know this flood's coming when Nibiru comes through, because it's going to knock the ice shelf into the ocean, and mankind is too noisy, and there's too many of them, and I want done with them. He was really into getting rid of us.
Yeah.
His brother, Enki, gets this dream message. This is all in the 11th tablet of Gilgamesh. That's why I say it's such an important story, because that's the feature of it. Message comes from the creator of all that the destiny of the Anunnaki was to come to Earth to create mankind, but the destiny of mankind is to inherit the planet. Therefore, they must save them, and Enki was given the information of how to save them, which, of course, was the Ark story, you know, Noah and all the animals. But that message was something that when the flood was over and Enki and Enlil came down to see the damage, because it was horrendous what happened, and then they encounter Noah and his people on this, you know, vessel coming to rest on the mountainside, Enlil's furious. He looks, because they all swore an oath. Enlil made them all swear an oath that they wouldn't help mankind to survive. And he turns on his brother, his half-brother, actually, and he says, you know, you did this. And Enki says, oh, wait a minute. He says, I got a dream message from the creator of all, and our destiny was to come here and create mankind, and their destiny is to inherit the earth. That's why they were saved by what I did. His brother, Enlil, does a 180-degree turn. Well, if the destiny, if the creator of all said that's the destiny, we got to help him. That's, you know, and that's when all this transfer started.
Huh. So all the creation of Sumeria and everything, that, and yeah, all the information they gave us, that all came after the flood?
The wheel, music, art, astrology, astronomy. I mean, all those things existed in the early Vikings around the Sumerian civilization, and everybody's, you know, they arrived with all their marble.
What's the mainstream anthropologist's explanation? They just don't offer one,
they
or do they have a flimsy one?
It goes against every rule that they have created in how evolution takes place and how societies build slowly and how cities, you know, people form into groups and da-da-da-da-da. Now, interesting parallel, Tim.
Yeah.
There's another story when Enki gets tossed out of Egypt and goes over to the New World and forms a whole new civilization, which is the Indian civilization over there.
Okay.
The same thing happens. The pyramids are built, and all of the transfers of astronomy, astrology, writing, new writing is developed. The Mayan writing is a new writing, and the calendar and so forth. But there's one thing that was withheld in the new civilization, the New World, and that was the wheel. See, the wheel was given to the Sumerians.
Huh.
And you won't find any evidence in the New World civilizations of the Incas, the Aztecs, the Olmecs, all those folks, of a wheel.
Is there a reason for that?
I don't... I can speculate. I'll tell you what my speculation is.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know if it was said somewhere in the text or...
No, it's not said anywhere. It's just, I saw this, and I said, uh-huh.
Yeah.
You can control people better if they don't have a wheel.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, that's just a guess on my part.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Wheels cause chariots, cause wars.
Yeah, exactly.
People have become too mobile, they move around.